It's Thursday, May 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, more big wins for Donald Trump while the Democrat presidential contenders split votes.
Generally speaking, the trend in presidential elections has been for the electorate to be increasingly non-white.
U.S. voting demographics are changing. Also ahead, the U.S. retail economy is slumping against online stores. Vietnam, though, has a booming economy. And finding your way with digital help. It's all on today's International Edition. We are all anxiously awaiting to see who will be the next U.S. president. Presumptive Republican Party presidential nominee Donald Trump scored two more victories Tuesday. He won West Virginia and Nebraska against no opposition. Democratic rivals, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders, split the vote. Clinton won in Nebraska, Sanders in West Virginia. However, Clinton maintains a wide delegate lead in the run-up to her party's nominating convention. That'll be in Philadelphia in July. Meanwhile, a new national poll suggests the likely contest between Trump and Clinton in key battleground states in November will be competitive. A Quinnipiac University poll Tuesday showed Trump closing in on Clinton's lead in Florida and Pennsylvania, even overtaking her in Ohio. Paul Brown is a spokesman, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty more.
In Ohio, Mr. Trump has a four-point lead, which is just outside the margin of error. In Florida and in Pennsylvania, former Secretary Clinton has a one-point lead that is not outside the margin of error. In other words, it's a tie. And we're 6 months out, so that's forever in politics. These numbers do show that we're looking at what could be a very competitive race in November.
These are the key battleground states, the ones that you just mentioned.
Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania are the most important states in a presidential election in the United States. And that's because no one has been elected president since 1960 without winning two of those three. So that the media, the candidates, everybody focuses on those three states.
The poll also found that Senator Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist, has a pretty enthusiastic following and would actually do better against Mr. Trump than Clinton in all three states if he were the nominee.
We tested Senator Sanders against Mr. Trump, and he does do a little bit better than Mrs. Clinton. The problem for Mr. Sanders is that it will take a comeback of epic proportions for him to win the Democratic nomination.
The insurgent Sanders campaign has shown weaknesses in Clinton's appeal to young and white working-class Democratic voters. Jeffrey Skelling, associate director of the Sabato Crystal Ball website of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, says the poll contained one surprise given the controversy surrounding Trump's style and substance.
It did show, interestingly, that Republican unity and Democratic unity were about the same in the three states that they polled. That sort of runs against expectations. And second, though, I think one thing you do have to sort of keep in mind when you're looking at any poll is that it's one poll and that it's not the end-all be-all. And I think there are some demographic questions. The electorates that they were sampling were whiter than the 2012 electorates in those states. And that seems somewhat unlikely to be the case once November rolls around. Perhaps Donald Trump supporters might argue the opposite, but generally speaking, the trend in presidential elections has been for the electorate to be increasingly non-white. In 2012, it was 72% white, the national electorate. There seems to be a lot of expectations that it'll be around 70% this time. That may not end up being the case, but nonetheless, the odds of it being more white nationally, the odds of that seem low. I think that's a reason to sort of take pause when you're looking at those numbers.
Jeffrey Skelling adds, with 6 months to go before the general election, a lot can happen that can affect the outcome, including the state of the economy, the effectiveness of Trump's campaign, and the status of the investigation into the way Mrs. Clinton handled classified email while she was Secretary of State. Well, we turn now to what's buzzing online. Our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, joins me here in the studio to give us the snippets. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, I hear Britain's Queen Elizabeth made some candid comments about some visiting Chinese officials.
That's right. But alas, not intentionally. Her comments were caught on camera, and now it's all over the internet. Chinese President Xi Jinping was in the UK last year for his first state visit to that country, and the Queen was caught on camera saying the officials were very rude during that visit. She was responding to a senior Metropolitan Police officer who said that being in charge of security for Xi's visit was a testing time for her.
Oh, the things we say when we think no one's listening. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the public's reaction like online?
I checked out the New York Times Facebook post on that article, and the most liked comment is about colonialism. A user named Vijay Vaidya wrote, "Colonialism was pretty rude too, Your Majesty. Nearly 1,500 people liked it." Another user argued, "It is not a shocker to find them rude and that the Queen calls it the way she sees it." Jim, I want to add that Beijing state-run CCTV and Xinhua News Agency have not tweeted about the controversy yet, and probably never.
I see. Well, what else is trending?
The next item is about a white nationalist group, support for presumptive GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump. The Trump campaign removed the chairman of a group called the American Freedom Party from its list of pledged convention delegates. His campaign explained the addition of William Johnson to that list was a computer error and that they fixed it. Jim, back to you.
Well, thank you for the wrap-up, G. And you can tweet your questions and comments to our Twitter page. That's at @VOA_IE. If you like, you may tag myself and G on those tweets. We're at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the top stories we're following and are trending now in Asia. Rescued son of ex-Pakistani leader returns home from Kabul. Bangladesh executes Islamist leader for wartime atrocities. 5 men held in Australia suspected of planning a trip to Syria. Economic slump leaves tough choices for Shanghai job seekers. High-tech devices take cheating to a new level in Thailand schools. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at our website, voanews.com, and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Large retail firms have been reporting first quarter earnings this week, and, well, the numbers have not been appealing to investors. Shopping malls may be a cool place to hang out, but the money doesn't seem to be flowing as it once did. VOA economics correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us with more from New York.
The thing is, as prices at the pump started to decline in 2015, analysts expect the consumer discretionary spending to uptick, which would benefit all retailers. But what the marketplace failed to recognize was how consumers were shopping versus how much they were spending and how that would impact the retail sector as a whole. So, for example, trends have really favored Amazon.com and online and mobile shopping. And it's not just anecdotal evidence from just about everyone that you talk to that supports this trend. It's drastically impacting the bottom line to department store earnings and single brand retailers. Both categories were slow on the take to put significant resources into online shopping and social media, especially the department stores. And we're seeing what's happening with companies like Macy's, JCPenney, Kohl's, Nordstrom. In fact, Macy's reported quarterly results this morning. They slashed profits and sales expectations by 15 to 20% for the year because same-store sales have dropped for the seventh time in 10 quarters. They're trying to combat that by adding cost-cutting measures and focusing on the segments that are working, like offline, and increasing their online presence, but it could be a case where it's too little too late because the environment has changed so quickly. Just look at how different it's been over the past year or two. Shopping habits are completely different than they were, say, 5-10 years ago, and part of that, I also think, could be because of social media. It's almost like we have digital peers right now, whereas when I was a kid, you would go to the mall, and that was your way of social interaction. So it's not even like the brick-and-mortar stores are part of social meeting anymore.
As the department stores struggle with their profits, what else is impacting the market today?
What else is is impacting the retailers is weather. And this is a very interesting story because weather, in every quarterly conference call you listen to, management always cites weather or where the quarter was in the calendar or there was more days this year than last year. But we had a phenomenon this year because it was 70 degrees on Christmas Day in New York City. And it was the same in D.C. as well. And you have so much winter apparel, jackets, boots, that were just building up in the stores because there was no demand for it. It was great for retailers like TJ Maxx, Burlington Coat Factory, Ross Stores, because they were getting that inventory passed through, getting great deals on their end, passing it through to the consumer, and that's what increased foot traffic there. We're seeing that double whammy in the spring of 2016 because we've been wearing winter jackets up until yesterday, and it's the middle of May. So now they're stuck with all of the spring inventory, and we're going to see the same phenomenon happen again. So right now, unless you are online like an Amazon, you're a discounter, or you're in the right trend at leisure like Nike, Under Armour with the yoga pants and the cool sneakers, it's going to be really, really tough for the Gaps of the world, the Macy's of the world.
Always fashionable and our resident expert on all things financial, Jill Malandrino, thanks for stopping by.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Well, many large companies from the West and elsewhere have found Southeast Asia to be a great place to do business, whether it's affordable labor, manufacturing, or on the retail level. VOA's Jim Randall has been looking at Vietnam. It's a fascinating story in place, and he joins us now in the studio to describe some of the reasons for that nation's fast economic growth.
Vietnam's economy has been undergoing a long and arduous and stop and start and back and forth a brand of reforms, many of which are beginning to bear fruit. The economy is one of the fastest growing on the planet, and foreign investors, particularly multinational corporations, GE, Intel, and big companies like even McDonald's, are taking an interest and are opening either have or are opening operations there. I spoke with the head of the GE section that works in ASEAN, and he said they're maintaining jet engines there for the local airlines. They're building healthcare equipment, high-tech healthcare equipment that peers into people's bodies and helps doctors figure out what's wrong with them to help them out, and all kinds of different activities that including making wind turbines that are built in Vietnam but exported all over the world from the factory there. They've got 900 people working there. Other companies have a lot of people working there, and it appears that this is growing. There are also some problems. I spoke with a professor at Indiana University who is Vietnamese. He grew up there. He was educated in Russia and in the UK and here in the United States. And so he has an interesting perspective on things. He says corruption is a significant problem, remains a significant problem. But he says the government is working on it. They're trying various approaches to try to root out corruption. And he says it's tough. And it's probably going to take a long time, maybe 10 years, to get a handle on it and to at least keep it down to a reasonable minimum. He also said something interesting. The big multinationals are so powerful that they're not going to be intimidated or pushed around by somebody demanding a bribe or something. They're just not going to, you know, they're able to, they're robust enough and experienced enough because they operate in many countries to survive that. But a smaller company could be pushed around by various officials demanding informal taxes, is one way to put it. That's a problem because the sort of the received wisdom is that small business is the part of the economy that creates the most jobs. So if small businesses are the most vulnerable to corruption, then that's putting a real monkey wrench into the engine of job creation. And so that's a big problem.
Hanoi, like many of the governments in the region, always had kind of a tight hand on what was going on in the country. That has changed.
Well, it has, up to a point. I mean, they're letting go in many sectors. The number of state-owned enterprises, for example, is way down. And their competitors in the private sector complain that the state-owned enterprises got maybe free land or they got many, many things that gave them a competitive advantage. And there are fewer of them now. Most analysts will tell you that the private sector companies are far more efficient and far more productive per, you know, per hour of work, per $100 of investment in capital and so forth, they're far more productive than the state-owned enterprises. So just changing from one to the other helps the economy grow.
The sentiment seems to be, with this newer generation too, more welcoming to the West.
Well, I was in Vietnam quite a while ago, and I was with the first U.S. ambassador to Vietnam. I was traveling with him and some other top U.S. officials. And the Vietnamese refer to the American War. Now, that was, they, since then, they fought other wars, and they've gotten past the American War. And it was pretty clear that for many Vietnamese, the idea that we could trade with each other and get rich and fat was far better than fighting with one another and getting dead. So they're very pragmatic and very thoughtful, and they have certainly, some of them have gotten past the wartime anger and frustrations and are trying to move on to a more positive future.
Great analysis, and always good to hear about hope. Jim, thank you so much for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
And be sure to visit voanews.com for more on this story, and you can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Traveling to a strange city can be a bit challenging, but a hotel in New York is using the latest digital technology to help its guests navigate the Big Apple. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the hotel uses the latest information from the Time Out Travel Group to help guests have a truly interactive experience.
Step into the lobby of the Renaissance Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, and you might notice two bright blue footprints on the floor. Step onto those footprints and several large circles appear on the floor with 10-minute walk, 20-minute walk, 30-minute walk, and other titles in them. Pick one of the circles, and attractions, restaurants, and things to do within that distance pop up on a screen in front of you. See something you like? Well, you can learn more by just pointing at it. David DeFalco is the hotel's general manager.
So you step into the two footsteps that are actually on the ground to give you some direction on that. And the first thing you'll notice is six buckets will appear on the ground. And those buckets have different parameters around them. So, for example, one of the buckets will say 10-minute walk, and another bucket will say morning. So if you step into the 10-minute walk bucket, you will have nine pieces of content that will display on the screen in front of you that give you nine different attractions to be able to go to that are within a 10-minute walk of the property.
DeFalco says that pointing at an attraction you see causes a tile to blow up on the screen in front of you, and you can get very detailed information about that attraction, like prices, hours, menus for restaurants, and other information. The content comes from the Time Out New York portal, part of the worldwide Time Out Travel Network. David DeFalco says the information is refreshed daily from Time Out, so what you see is the latest information.
The partnership with Time Out is that our server every morning pulls content from their server at 4 a.m. and refreshes all of the items up on the Discovery portal to ensure that they're still relevant and that we have the newest and greatest attractions that fall into the buckets on the ground.
The digital elements are designed to appeal to young people, something that Jessica Rodriguez of the Wagstaff Worldwide Marketing Company says is vital for the travel and tourism business.
I don't think the traditional hotel experience has gotten stale necessarily, but I do think that we do that there is a need for wow factors as part of a differentiator for a brand narrative story or to get people to book into your hotel.
David DeFalco says that his hotel sits at a crossroads and aims to meet the needs of all its guests.
Renaissance is really starting to move down the road of really catering to the millennial traveler. We're at a very unique time right now in the travel industry. We have three full generations traveling with us. We have baby boomers, we have Gen X, we have Gen Y. It's a very unique situation to be in as a hotelier as we're trying to cater to all of those needs as we go forward.
The Renaissance Hotel in Midtown Manhattan opened in March of this year in the Garment District neighborhood across from Penn Station and Madison Square Garden. All the digital elements are located on the ground floor. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition, and as you probably already know, we're quite digital ourselves. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA Now, and you can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. But we also rely on the best human intelligence and talent as well in our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back when you can. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power told the U.N. Security Council that after 7,000 years, the very existence of the Syrian city of Aleppo is in doubt. The military escalation that has occurred there in recent days has set the city ablaze and killed more than 270 civilians. While all sides have contributed to the violence, said Ambassador Power, the military escalation was attributable largely to the actions of a single party, the Assad regime. The regime launched more than 300 airstrikes, 110 artillery strikes, and 18 missiles, and dropped more than 68 bombs on the city over just these last 2 weeks. Ambassador Power rejected claims by the Syrian regime and its supporters that the attacks were aimed at al-Nusra or Daesh terrorists. The sites hit in Aleppo show otherwise, she said, pointing to the targets that were hit, including an ambulance, a bakery, a public market, and a mosque. The Assad regime, she noted, has taken additional measures that show its overt intention to ratchet up civilian suffering in Aleppo, the restriction of humanitarian access and blocking of aid, the deliberate targeting of first responders, healthcare workers, and medical facilities. This is willful targeting. Ambassador Power said that there are three tracks necessary to make progress for peace in Syria overall: stopping the fighting, improving humanitarian access, and engaging in political negotiations to bring about transition. This, she noted, is what the Security Council agreed to last December when it passed Resolution 2254. What has been happening in Aleppo shows that all these tracks are in grave peril. While there is blame to go around, the primary responsibility lies with the Assad regime, said Ambassador Power, which has shown blatant disregard for Resolution 2254, not only by its actions in Aleppo, but by similar actions throughout the country. All those with influence, particularly Russia and Iran, must press the regime to meet its commitments and obligations, said Ambassador Power. For our part, the United States will continue pressing the opposition to do the same. And we will work with our Russian counterparts to try to restore a real and lasting cessation of hostilities in Aleppo and elsewhere in Syria, and to facilitate a political transition away from Assad, the only way in which this war will finally end.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.